Okay, so my job today is really to provide the foundation for understanding what I see as a resurgence in research and what we've learned from it and what that means for the next generation. And I was looking at this slide this morning and I was thinking, you know, I was saying to Margaret, and thank you for inviting us to do this, I was thinking, I started feeling really crabby about this because I was thinking, usually what I say is, no, I don't have any financial relationships. I'm a sociologist. Nobody has financial anything, right? But then I started thinking about the issue of stigma and mental health, and I started getting really crabby and saying, every one of us in this room likely has a financial relationship with this issue of stigma, because stigma goes across the board to discriminate financially against people with mental illness, against their families, against the services that they are offered, against the kind of housing that they can get, and for providers in the field, the kinds of resources they are given compared to, say, cardiology or oncology. So I started feeling really crabby as I read this, saying, yes, I have a financial relationship, and I have lots and lots of relationships to disclose on this. But I decided that I would just move on to the next slide and not spend the whole time crabbing, although I could do that easily. So just to, you know, and I have 22 minutes that I've been, Rebecca has told me. And so I just wanted to, I've given out a handout. If you didn't get one, I don't have any more, but I can send you one so that I've tried to provide that summary. But I just wanted to start off reminding everybody what stigma is and the role of Irving Goffman in really bringing this to the fore of not only science but policy as a mark. Stigma is the mark. What is a result of the mark is the prejudice and discrimination that comes with it, because the mark really reduces somebody from what we consider to be a fully functioning human being to an image of somebody who is devalued by society and that they're considered less than fully human. And there are many types. And one of the things that we need to do in the next generation of stigma research is really to think about how those different types actually come together to produce double hits, triple hits, and those kinds of things. The research on that is very sparse at this point. So I wanted just to start off with the idea that that the first stigma studies were actually commissioned by Congress. And Shirley Starr is famous for having the Mimeo, which is the most famous unpublished document ever in mental illness or mental health, because she inherited this Joint Committee of Congress study that was done by NORC at University of Chicago. And of course, in 1950, she found what you would expect. The Mimeo is 1955, but the survey was actually done in 1950, which is, you know, profound generalized ignorance, negative attitudes surrounding every aspect of mental health and treatment, and very high levels of social rejection. And, you know, this sort of research, there were little studies that were done. There was one that was done in Louisville, Kentucky, that was sponsored by Collier's Magazine. And then there were people who were doing really important research to show what was happening with regard to people who were stigmatized. And then, at least in sociology, because I think people like Pat and Bruce Link, you know, they kept carrying the torch during what I call the lull, because what happened in sociology, for example, is that there was an argument between Sheff and Gove, Tom Sheff, who believed mental illness is a myth, which was the way, the sort of basic training I received in sociology in the 70s, and Walter Gove, who argued was that it was really the behaviors that were problematic, it wasn't the label. And they argued about this, but they didn't have any new data, and so it just kind of fizzled out for many people. But by the time we hit that lull, at least in my part of my sort of neighborhood of social science, we knew that that stigma was a foremost obstacle to recovery. We knew it harmed self-esteem as well as life chances and lifestyles, things like social exclusion, isolation. We knew that it reduces access to care and the resources that go into mental health treatment and research. And that it turns out that that Bruce Link showed by the 1980s that the label was very powerful regarding stigma, but it didn't really set into motion what labeling theorists had said, which was this adoption of the ideas of what mental illness was, and that's what produced chronic mental illness. And so that was a really path-breaking study there. The thing that got me involved in it, those of you who know me, that my real passion is understanding pathways to mental health treatment. And that I was sort of battling the sort of rational choice model of how people get into care, suggesting that it was an issue that involved others, not just a cost balance in your head. And after we were able to establish the social networks mattered in very interesting and complex ways for the kinds of pathways that people traveled to care or never got to care, I started thinking about what's inside those networks. And I started thinking, well, stigma. I was a classically trained sociologist. So I went into the literature and I found a presidential address, and the American Psychiatric Association 2004 president announced that stigma had dissipated in the United States. And the hair on the back of my neck kind of stood up as a social scientist, was like, okay, I'm not going to tell them which medications to give out, but they're not going to tell me what's happened with American culture. And so I called Bruce Link and I said, am I right about this, that there hasn't been a national study since Shirley Starr? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, well, we can't have this. So thus began my entry into stigma. So the questions, and what was really curious about this, and Rebecca had asked me just a half an hour ago, you know, when would you date this kind of resurgence? And it wasn't, you know, Bruce and I deciding we needed to do the national stigma study in 1996, because already at that point, we were able to build the argument to do that based on a provincial study provincial studies that were done in Canada by Heather Stewart, studies that were done by CRISP in Britain, studies that were I'm going to forget his name. Pat, you know, the German. Matthias Angermeyer in Germany. They had all come to this point where it was like, we need to know the state of stigma. And so around the mid-90s, there was this beginning of these national data sets, and it was embarrassing for America to be the one that we had no clue, and we were saying things like stigma has dissipated in the United States. I mean, I had just spent 9 months in the two largest psychiatric units in Indianapolis, and I got to tell you, I saw no evidence that it had disappeared. So these were the questions that we asked. Has it dissipated? What are its roots? And how has this worked in with the sort of human genome project, saying that we're going to find the answer to everything in the 3 billion base pairs? Well, I handed this out, which of course, you know, it's sort of the greatest time in social science to find out that, no, it didn't give us the book of life. But I am feeling crabby today, I guess. So anyway, all right, so I've given you a handout which has the summary of all this stuff. But basically what I wanted to say was that there's good news and bad news since the 1950s, right? It's not all bad news. There's a lot of good news. Public is more sophisticated. The greatest change that we saw from the studies that, you know, we unearthed both at the University of Michigan and the University of Chicago was the greatest change was the willingness of Americans to talk to family and friends about their mental health problems. But stigma was alive and well. We now know there are gradients of intimacy. The more intimate the venue, the more stigma. And it matters what kind of mental health problem you have, because up until then, people were asking about mental illness. The problem with that is we didn't have any idea what they were thinking of. Were they thinking of the child with ADHD? Were they thinking of, you know, Freddy and those horrible movies? And so what we did was we developed these vignettes, which is what people would face in the community, which is a person experiencing mental health symptoms. Well, in order for people to pay attention to it, these symptoms had to match DSM criteria, because otherwise they would say, well, there are those sociologists again going off and doing their own thing that nobody cares about. So Bruce, as a, you know, first epidemiologist of the first rank, wrote them. We then sent them to psychiatrists who rewrote them as sort of med exam questions. And then we gave them to a survey methodologist who was my husband, and then he made them into language that was good for the American population. And so, you know, we found out other things. It's good, you know, people think that psychiatric meds, and this kind of worries me on some level, psychiatric meds are in fact efficacious and they don't have many side effects. You know, all I can think is they must have been thinking SSRIs. But they want you to take them, they're not going to take them. We talk a lot about targeting, with regard to anti-stigma, but you know, the sociodemographics are very, very weak in like who is more stigmatizing. Because people always say to me, well, of course, people who are educated are less stigmatizing. No. Okay, people who are politically left are less stigmatizing. No. Well, you know, African Americans are more, you know, they have a greater concern with stigma. No. But what we did find is that there was, that it's really, there's this whole cultural bundle that once you start thinking about what causes mental illness, it trips you into a whole bunch of other things about mental illness. And we found, we did the national stigma study children and found out that Americans were much more kind to people and inclusive to children and adolescents, except those with depression. And I think we can thank the media for that in terms of the way they report on school shootings. And that this whole idea of is it the behavior, is it the label, is obsolete, just like, you know, the nature and nurture debate, because guess what? Both have an independent effect on stigma. I've already mentioned about the cultural bundle. Americans have grabbed onto neuroscience. It's changed their ideas about what causes mental illness, but it hasn't changed their ideas about rejection. Even worse, Joe Phelan found that there's a potential genetic backlash regarding stigma. If you believe that stigma is located in your genes, then you really don't want people to marry into your family. So science hasn't always been helpful for us on this, because it's sort of been broad science and not really talking about all the other things that are important. There is global variation in stigma. And we do know now that things like public stigma matter, because in studies going across countries, we found that countries that have higher levels of public stigma also have individuals who report more stigmatizing experiences, greater self-stigma, and less willingness to use services. So the contemporary challenges really are still there. We know that life expectancy is much lower for people with mental health problems, that there is now a fundamental critique and rethinking of what we should be doing, and it really involves two questions. What should the messages be, and how do we reconfigure strategies? So I wanted to show you this because this has been, as far as I can tell, the most effective thing, which is that this shows when a line does, when a line goes through the one axis line there, that means that there's no effect. And what you can see is that there are places for certain problems where there has been a change in embrace of more scientific attitudes and lower embrace of attitudes that have to do with moral components of what causes mental illness. That's all good. There is one place where it's a problem, which is there's more negative attribution now for people with substance disorders that we need to think about. But the one on the right, the graph on the right, shows you the one of the cleanest results I've ever seen in my career, which is there's absolutely no change in stigma whatsoever over the 10 years when we began to throw a lot at the issue of mental illness. We also went across countries, as Rebecca had mentioned, and these are in the AJPH piece, but what I want to tell you is that when you see a circle that is larger and darker, that means that there's greater endorsement of that idea. So you see here that even across the what we call the low and middle income countries now, that there is this embrace of these scientific attributions, and while there are pockets of severe misinformation in some of the countries, in general, even around the world, people have gotten the message that this is a disease, that mental illnesses are diseases. But what we haven't gotten is a sense that stigma has been reduced, because no matter which country you're looking at, and we have countries that are very, very low on stigma, like Iceland, to countries that are very, very high on stigma, like Bangladesh, that there are these items at the bottom here, these five items, in which at least half of the population in every country stigmatizes people with mental illness on these issues. And that one is for schizophrenia. And then with regard to depression, I think there are four items. And these really should, we should really think about these in terms of our future targets for change in public health. So we do know that there is a backbone of stigma that exists, and there are some other things that we may feel are very important, but we're going to have the possibility for very little change because people around the globe have already bought into not believing certain stigmatizing issues. Now, of course, what people say to me is, well, do you think they believe it in their heart of hearts? And why do you do public stigma anyway? And I say two things. One, I don't care if they believe it in their heart of hearts, as long as they know better than to spout it out. And the second thing is I think that this gives us a litmus test for the kinds of things that we need to work at. So I also believe that it's very hard to change hearts and minds, and that you'll see where we've gone in terms of our efforts to try to change things in the U.S. Okay. The other thing that we've learned is that it's a very, very complicated system of stigma. And we have a framework in which we've tried to sort of lay out all of the different things that go into creating stigma. And to think about this, I use this sometimes, to think about this, I don't know how many of you remember the whack-a-mole game, you know, where you hit something, you reduce it, but it pops up somewhere else. And if we don't take a systems approach to reducing stigma, I think it's going to have that kind of effect. So I'm not saying that people can actually operationalize this framework, but to really be cognizant of the context in which we're doing our work. I think that's the model of that. So what we've decided to do, and I got a call one day, and I've mentioned to many people that I got a call, and the call was, "Hi, this is Glenn Close." And I was like, "Yeah, really funny, who is this?" But it turned out it really was Glenn Close, and I'm the head of her scientific advisory board. Her group, Bring Change to Mind, wants everything they do to be based on science, which again is a dramatic change in thinking about how people think about stigma reduction. So she has three prongs of her work right now. She's very interested in PSAs, and so we've developed a method to evaluate PSAs and their efficacy on a national level and on a cognitive science level. She's with Steve Hinshaw, whose book, The Mark of Shame You May Know, is doing Let's Clubs in high schools. And after Glenn's visit to Indiana University, she and the first lady of IU decided that we should do a college toolbox. And after Glenn left, and she's a little bit like the Energizer Bunny, you know, and the tornado. And so after a couple of months of, you know, trying to sort of get back to my teaching and research from that, I called her and I said, "So Glenn, where's this toolbox that you want me to evaluate?" And she said, "Evaluate it? You're going to develop it." And I'm thinking, I am not an interventionist, right? And so I'm always happy to be here at APHA, where, you know, a lot of people here in the trenches, and I so appreciate what you do. But we're the pilot site doing the science to say what works and what doesn't work. And so what the first thing we learned is that this has to be by students for students. It can't come down from the top. Many of you may know Alcohol EDU, which is an important program, but what we've learned at IU is that students, because it's forced on them, they do get a 99% response rate. But what the students do is they have made up a drinking game to go along with Alcohol EDU. Some of them make their parents take it for them. And so we decided that we were not going to go the coercive route. This is a very interesting but difficult thing to do. So we decided to follow one cohort of students and see how they change over time. And I have, they don't call them freshmen anymore, they call them first-year students, because we actually had one student come in with enough credits to be a senior from AP high school stuff. But we decided that we wanted to not just talk to the choir, but do whole campus engagement. So we have academic competitions, which you'll see some examples of, events, classes, and trainings. And so the way that we've organized this is that there's a student advisory board that is made up of two student leaders and either a leader or liaison from every major group on campus. If you want to engage at one of these big schools, you've got to engage the Greeks. Right, you've got to engage the fraternities and sororities. And, you know, that's where we have to understand the culture of each of these places, because if you're going to engage Oberlin versus IU, it's going to look very different. So we have a promotions team and then ambassadors who, you know, these are people who want to help occasionally. The promotions team is pretty regular. So right now we have about 400 students engaged just in the what we call the Champions of Change. And so they do things like this. IU has a thing every year that they do called the Cardboard Regatta, and UBC2M created a boat. All right, the boat sunk, but we did win best boat, right, with our black and lime green on that. Students, I was so excited about this. Students wanted class credit, and they wanted to be educated on things that really bothered them. And what's really bothering them this right now is school shootings. And so the Honors College organized a 7 a.m. breakfast meeting, and look at all the students who showed up, to understand about school shootings. And so I had done, I have a TED Talk on this online, and so I basically did the TED Talk for them and reassured them about Bloomington and why I thought Bloomington was a place that had a low probability of having this happen. But that's important because I think the guns, mental illness, political response is the wrong one. We also had a, we have a competition, and next week at Glenn's fundraising gala, the students who won are coming. Their winning campaign was to have a kickball tournament. The kickball tournament is called Kick Stigma in the Balls. The winner will get to come, the team captain will get to, apparently at Big Ten universities they love to do these tournaments, and they do, they're going to get 42 teams to start and whatever. There's a course called, the students named it, hashtag Stigma Sucks, where we teach them all the things that might be useful for this. And then my last thing is just to give you a sense of the design of this. So we're doing a evidence-based pilot over five waves, which looks not only at their overall attitudes and behaviors of inclusion, but also is targeted toward the entire cohort, but then a representative sample of the entering cohort over five points in time to sort of see, to document not only how those things change, but to also document their participation, because every time they go to an event, they're free, but they have to swipe their ID. So we know who goes to what and when and why. Okay? So that's where we are. Any questions about the College Toolbox and our plans for next stages, we can answer in Q&A. Thank you.